if you're polarized, and if all, if that means that all of your values are ultimate, and the ultimate good is at stake in everything that you care about, it's going to be very hard for you, literally, to live with other people.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org.
In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Robin Lovin about his new book, What Do We Do When Nobody Is Listening? Leading the Church in a Polarized Society. Robin is an ordained minister in the United Methodist Church. He also served as a professor of ethics at Southern Methodist University. And he's offering us some insights to think about this polarized world that we live in and the role of Christians in not adding to that polarization, but also providing an alternative. So I think you'll find this to be an important and timely conversation. And we even talk a little bit about what's happening with the Methodist Church today. Before we jump into this, I want to remind you that you really should subscribe to Word and Way's award-winning email newsletter, A Public Witness. Learn more and start reading today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. And now here's my conversation with Robin Lovin on What Do We Do When Nobody Is Listening? Well, Robin, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So I'm excited to talk to you about your new book, What Do We Do When Nobody Is Listening? Leading the Church in a Polarized Society. And I guess we should start with that title. You seem to think our society is polarized?
Yes, I think there's substantial evidence of that if you look at the world around us. I have said to a number of people since the book was published last summer that my only regret is that I may have been too optimistic about the current state of society. I do think there was some good news out of the midterm elections, but part of what I was trying to say in the first part of the book is this isn't something that has happened in the last 4 years or the last 8 years. This is a long-term trend that I think begins after the divisions and the splits caused by the civil rights movement, and as the society is fragmented more with different kinds of identity politics. And those are not in themselves bad developments, but our political system, our social relationship seem to have had a very difficult time responding to those changes.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about why you decided to write this book. What was it? I mean, you're getting a little bit of, you said you were optimistic and you're talking a little bit about what was happening in our society, but you know, you've mostly spent your life as a professor and, you know, educating leaders, and here you wrote a more popular audience, you know, focused book. So why this book now?
Well, I don't want to overstate the way in which I've been exclusively involved in academics. That has been my job for most of my career. But I started off as a parish pastor, and partly I'm responding to the difficulties that I see people having dealing with, as the subtitle suggests, this is really written for people who have leadership positions in the church. I could have technical arguments about theology with my academic colleagues, and we could refine some of these points. But I was trying to get at some basic themes that I hope will be of help to people who have to hold congregations together during these times.
So, of course, then we'll kind of walk through a little bit of what you're arguing and talking about in this book. And I mean, I think we should start with that whole polarization concept. And you spend some time at the beginning explaining how our society is polarized. What is it that you see? And I know you're saying this isn't something that just happened in the last, you know, couple of years, last few years, but what do you see that's happening in this moment that is perhaps unique? You know, particularly we're talking about, you know, churches and Christians acting in this moment, but what is it about the polarization that we're experiencing now that's maybe different than when you were early in your career as a local minister?
Well, that's a very good question, because I'm constantly drawn back to, as I suggested, the divisions around the civil rights movement, the war in Vietnam. All of those things were occupying our attention when I was a parish minister, when I just graduated from seminary. Certainly, social media and the way that people get their information has changed dramatically in those years. I think that feeds the polarization, as many people have noted. At the same time, I don't want to blame all of that on the media. You could make the same argument about the rise of print newspapers in the early part of the 19th century. You know, whether we could have had a civil war without print media is an interesting question, and it seems to me in the same way you can ask whether we would have had this kind of polarization with the media that we had available in the 1960s and 1970s. I doubt it. But beyond that, as I suggested a minute ago, the rise of identity politics and the way in which people feel that their identity and their very existence is at stake in the political relationships they have within the society makes for a difficult political environment. It's in the nature of politics, after all, that it involves disagreement, argument, compromise. And we seem to have created a situation in which, instead of seeing compromise as something that's essential to political and social life, we see it as a threat. And I think the polarization of religious life has contributed to that. So that's a particular reason why pastors and church leaders ought to pay attention to these problems.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned the Civil War, and you know, we both come from a tradition that divided before the war on North-South lines, mm-hmm. Methodists and Baptists. And, you know, in many ways, I've seen historical scholars talk about this as not just prefiguring the Civil War, but also helping the Civil War actually happen.
Yes, right.
So because the large churches split, that helped tear the country apart. And does it feel like we're having a bit of that same, I'm not suggesting we're heading to the Civil War, but a sense of that, since it's not just the political polarization. As you just noted, this polarization is happening in our churches, in our denominations as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. The way in which it's embedded in, as you suggest, social institutions like churches, the way in which it is mirrored in our demographics, you know, it's really interesting to me that we can talk about red states and blue states, that the political differences are echoed state by state, county by county, really. The result is not only because of social media, but because of where we live and how we live, we don't have to deal with people who see the world differently. And it's easier, it simplifies our lives. If we operate on the basis that we're right and they're wrong, without having necessarily to get into the details of what we agree or disagree about.
Yeah, so then, you know, obviously this raises the question then for churches. I mean, you know, political polarization, there's a lot of topics we could talk about. The one that you're focused on is how does a church operate in this context in which we find ourselves, in which there really is, you know, significant political polarization. And a key part that you write about in the book, and you should probably unpack this a bit for those who haven't yet checked out the book, is this idea from Dietrich Bonhoeffer of taking up space in the world. What does that mean, and how are you seeing that relevant to our polarized society?
The idea that Bonhoeffer was working with there, and it's something he says in just a few paragraphs as he's writing the manuscript that will eventually become what we know as his Ethics. He was writing it, of course, in the midst of his own struggles with Nazi Germany, and trying to explain the role of a church in that society, in which the German Christian movement thought that their task was to support their country, to support their leader in everything. And in effect, Bonhoeffer says, the church disappears in that context because you can't tell the difference between the people who are part of the church and all the people in the rest of society. So for him, it becomes a criterion of where do we find the real church? The real church takes up space. It makes its presence known in large and small ways, so that it can't simply be absorbed into the social movements that are going on around it. And my fear at the moment is that many churches have consciously or unconsciously adapted to the polarization. And it isn't so much that they agree with it or that they want to stand strongly on one side or another, though there are churches that are that way. But the people who are likely to pick up this book are not the crusaders for one side or another in our cultural wars. It's people who are making adjustments to the controversies within their congregations, trying to damp down the tension within the group, figuring out how to present their message in such a way that that it attracts one group of people and maybe not another, and in all of those. Well, here's the thing, I guess, you know, for a politician, there may not be anything wrong with polarization. If politics is about, at least about winning elections, polarization is a pretty good, as we are seeing, a pretty good strategy for making that happen. To say the church takes up space is to say we're supposed to be about something different in this environment. And you can't both be the church and simply collaborate with the polarization that's going on around you. I think, yeah, that was Bonhoeffer's conviction at the time, it cost him a great deal, obviously, to hold that. And we admire him for it, but we need to think about what that means in our context as well.
Yeah, because, I mean, you mentioned this idea that polarization and intentionally fanning the flames and adding to the divides can be a successful political strategy for a politician or a party. But I mean, it could also be a church growth strategy. I mean, we've seen this. So some churches are leaning into the politics and leaning into the polarization and they're packing the pews. So that temptation exists there as well. But what you're saying is, hey, at what point does this no longer offer anything unique?
Yes.
In the society, it's just the country, or it's just the party at prayer singing a few songs, but the church isn't actually being anything.
I think that is exactly the risk. And when you say, at what point does the church simply lose its identity? And answer to that question is, it loses its identity at the point that it can no longer stand for one God who is the source and center of all creation. And certainly a lot of popular use of religion as a piece of the social polarization is pretty much built around, you know, the idea that God is on our side and not on yours. And I think there are deep theological problems with that. The book is in part a challenge to people to think about how their most basic convictions about God and God's relationship to the world relate to these polarizing political and social phenomena.
And I mean, your book is not about COVID, although there are a couple of references scattered throughout, sprinkled throughout. And it does seem like COVID in our society, in our churches, exasperated, sped up perhaps some polarization trends that were already happening. What part do you see that playing in this, particularly the impact that it's had with churches in the sense of, you know, not just echoing or mirroring the polarization that's happening in society?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things about it, of course, is the pandemic, almost by definition, was unavoidable for the churches. They had to deal with it. Our choir director pointed out very early in the pandemic, there are a few things you can do that spread viruses as rapidly as singing with in the way that John Wesley would have wanted us Methodists to sing. So whereas before the pandemic and apart from those pandemic issues, one strategy for the church was always, you know, simply to avoid the questions, make sure that the divisive issues are not raised in the context of worship. But that became unavoidable in when you had to make a decision about masks, when you had to talk about whether or not people should be vaccinating their children, whether they could bring their children to a daycare center or something like that without vaccination. So certainly the pandemic itself became polarizing, and then the church found itself unable to avoid that particular piece of the polarization. Yeah,
that's right. You couldn't not take a side. You couldn't avoid the issues because to continue to do everything as you always have done was to take a side in the polarization that was occurring.
Yes, exactly. And of course, that's true in relation to many other issues, but it just was so obvious around those pandemic problems.
Yeah, so then this idea of taking up space in the world, you also kind of talk about this as the church finding a way of resistance, of enacting and resisting culture, society, you know, values. I wonder if you could talk about why that's important and how churches today can live out a resistance to the polarization of our society.
One has to be a little careful, perhaps maybe more careful than I was about the language of resistance, because that in itself can be polarizing. But of course, I was trying to think with Bonhoeffer, with the people in the German resistance. We have the advantage of being able to do that in an atmosphere of relative freedom, so that we don't immediately attract the unfavorable attention of the authorities, although we may attract somebody's unfavorable attention just by speaking up. But Bonhoeffer reminds us that if we are being the church, there will be points at which we're in resistance to the society around us. That's another way of talking about taking up space. So I think what I was trying to do, and certainly what I see Bonhoeffer doing, is challenging us with the idea that if the picture your congregation presents to the world doesn't challenge anybody, doesn't seem to be in resistance to the world around you at some point, then, you know, that's not necessarily an indication of the effectiveness of your evangelism. It may well be an indication that you're glossing over, passing over some of the elements of the gospel message that ought to be challenging the people in your own community.
And then, of course, there's the opposite risk, which is the, you know, pretending that our polarization, our partisanship is some sort of prophetic resistance, right? So we resist our culture during this 4-year period, but then not the next 4-year period when a different president or a different party is in charge, right? Yeah. That's not really resistance. That's just adding to the polarization.
Yeah, that too.
I mean, because isn't that a danger that we have? You were talking earlier about red states and blue states and red states, red counties and blue counties. And, you know, it often seems like we also have red churches and blue churches today.
Yes, exactly. That's part of what I mean by a polarized society, is that strategies of adjustment to that polarization become the key to success, you know, all across the spectrum. So businesses have to figure out how they're going to deal with, issues of marriage equality, issues of racial justice, and so forth, and how they're going to present their brand, as it were, in ways that will be acceptable to broadest number of people in the market. Now, all of that, as I say, for a politician or a business person, may at a superficial level at least be an appropriate form of action. It's less clear that the church can behave that way. I think another thing that I do try to say in the book is that what all institutions have in common, the enduring structures of society, is that they're about creating certain kinds of goods. And those goods inevitably are in competition with other goods. So to be a responsible person in society is to know how to be an advocate for the goods that you care about and that you have devoted your life to, without denying that there are other values. That's back to Bonhoeffer's language again. Polarization turns all of our differences into ultimate questions. And Bonhoeffer wanted to insist on the importance of the penultimate, the thing that in comes across better in German maybe than it does in English. It's the thing that is just before the most important thing. So not trivial, but also not ultimate. Those are the things around which we can make common cause with other people who may not share our ultimate beliefs about God or all of the values by which we hold our own lives together. But I guess another way that I would state Bonhoeffer's point is to say that if you're polarized, and if that means that all of your values are ultimate, and the ultimate good is at stake in everything that you care about, it's going to be very hard for you, literally, to live with other people. And that is, I think, you know, the situation in which we're finding ourselves.
I mean, it does seem like a really important point, even if we lose something in translation, of this focus between on the penultimate instead of the ultimate, because it does seem that in our society, a lot of political issues are treated as the ultimate, and we start dividing and excluding and casting out over sometimes even maybe a minor disagreement, and because we treat all of these issues as ultimate. And while when we gather in a church, we are saying that there are some ultimate matters, right? And this is what has brought us together, you know, is the reason why we gather. But that when we head out into this pluralistic society, there is this reminder that it's not the same and it's not always about the ultimate. I mean, I feel like this is a really important point in your book, is this understanding of what are the things that we gather together in church for and worship, and what are the ways that we act out in society in ways that we might be willing to actually compromise and actually, you know, listen to others that have different opinions with us.
Yeah. And again, there's a theological point that helps us hold those things together. And that's simply the recognition that God defines the ultimate, not us. That inevitably our values and commitments are partial. There again, it's tempting to get into the pulpit and you know, proclaim the importance of being totally committed to your faith and your community of faith, especially just before we pass the offering plate. But a theological awareness inevitably has to see the difference between a theocentric and an egocentric perspective on reality.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation. But first, I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation.
Then as you start in the second part of the book, you start trying to offer some ways that we can be a positive place in the world in, you know, offering something against the polarization to help, you know, heal the divides, if you will. And you talk about, you know, you really highlight this key of listening, which, you know, in a polarized world, right, the first thing we want to do is actually say our side. And, you know, here's what I believe, right, and this is why you're wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
And so you're encouraging us to listen. And I wanted to talk about these couple different areas that you're encouraging us to listen to. And the first one might seem like the more obvious and easy one, you know, for a minister to say, well, you should listen to the word of God. But I want to talk, you know, let's go a little bit beyond just maybe the Sunday school answer on that. And but you particularly focus on the virtues of faith, hope, and love in this chapter. And so I want to talk about, what is it that you think Christians can hear from the Word of God that will help them when they're dealing with a polarized society?
I think there's, let's make a theological distinction here between the eschatological and the apocalyptic. Eschatological, the last things, the ultimate things, to go back to the language I was using a moment ago, you know, to have faith is to believe that those ultimate things lie in God's hands. And then indeed, as Reinhold Niebuhr, another one of my favorite theologians, was like to say, you know, who's right and who's wrong will not finally be clear within history. It takes a lot of faith to believe that, because it means that if I take that eschatological view of things, then I'm committed to acting without knowing for sure that I'm right. That I always leave open the possibility that in the ultimate judgment, things are not going to be divided up exactly the way that I have been doing it, or maybe even not very much at all, like I have been doing it. That's as opposed to a more apocalyptic faith, which certainly has its place in the Christian tradition. But the apocalyptic faith is one that sees that ultimate judgment as happening now. And there again, like many churches, at this point in the church calendar, you know, I've been reading in Isaiah, you know, and one might say that in Isaiah you see the apocalyptic version of God's sovereignty and history working itself out, and it's not a very pleasant experience for the chosen people at that point. They are experiencing defeat and ruination. And that experience is redeemed in the prophetic word only by the confidence that God's ultimate judgment on history will vindicate their faithfulness.
Yeah. And so then, you know, the next thing you have us listening to, like I said, that's probably the easy one. People are like, oh yeah, sure. We should listen to God, and we should listen to the world. And so that for some, in some churches, that would be, now they might do it more than they're willing to admit, but just to openly say we should be listening to the world might seem scandalous. So, you know, what do you mean by that? How is that helpful as we're dealing with a polarized society?
Right. I think listening to the world, as you suggest, is something that most of us do have to do all the time. I set this particularly in the context of vocation. Our jobs or whatever it is that we work at in the world, you know, those things, as I say, are committed to creating and maintaining certain kinds of goods. And if and in order to do that, we have to listen to what's going on around us to figure out what the keys to success are. And I don't mean now success in the sense that we're going to let the world choose the goals, but precisely because we have a sense of the goals and the goods that we're committed to, we have to listen to what's going on around us to figure out how to achieve those things. The net effect of that, I think, is to concentrate our thinking on what I call a circle of responsibility, a range of relationships and institutions and problems that we really can take some responsibility for, and not trying to project that on the entire world so the problem is if we tend in a polarized society to say, if we fail, it's because somebody else was opposed to us. When in fact, most of the time, and I think most of us really know this, if we fail, it's because we weren't paying enough attention to the conditions for achieving the particular goods that we were trying to achieve. Max Weber, the great German sociologist of the early 20th century, built a contrast between what he called an ethics of ultimate ends and an ethics of responsibility. And I'm really building on that here. What Weber had in mind when he articulated that in 1918 was the rise of revolutionary socialism in Russia, in which everything was to be subordinate to the triumph of this new kind of society. Any failure was obviously the result of opposition that had to be eliminated. And Weber, I think, wisely tried to warn people who found that a very attractive option. Weber tried to warn people that's not real politics. Real politics is not acting beyond the results that you can see. And part of what that means is leaving the possibility for a change of course and for, you know, correcting your direction. Maybe not you yourself, but future generations. So the revolutionary answer, the polarizing answer, is always to say, make this choice now and you won't have to make any more choices. Weber's wise response to that is always make choices that leave room for future choices.
Yeah, and then you encourage us to listen to those who have not been heard. And I think this is a fascinating point, because in a polarizing society like ours, and we've already talked a little bit about, you know, social media and other types of media and politicians. I mean, there are a lot of voices. There are a lot of voices speaking loudly. There's a temptation to add our voices loudly to the conversations and the divides. And yet you're also reminding us that there are voices not being heard, and we need to listen to those.
Yeah, this is, of course, a lesson that I think liberation theologies have taught us. I said some critical things about identity politics and identity theologies, but at the same time, one of the things I say in the book is that identities are hard won, but they are easily exploited. A reason for that, I think, is we don't listen to the people who have an identity that puts them outside of the social mainstream. We want to encourage everybody, especially today, to fit into one of these two big groups. Inevitably, as you suggest, means we're not listening to what most people say. We hear just enough to decide you're for us or against us. And then we categorize people and move on. The question that I try to get people to ask in listening to those who are not heard, you know, that's not just an admonition to be nice and gentle and open and so forth. Those are all good things. It's partially the very self-interested notion that these people that you're not hearing may know something that would be really important, you know, to the success of things that are important to you. And surely we're finding that in churches, you know, churches that find themselves in a different neighborhood than the one that the church was built for. If you can't listen and hear the people that you're not hearing around you, pretty soon the pews are going to be empty. Listening, as I say, is about finding out what people know that's crucial to the success of things that are important to you, and building them into your plans and hopes.
Well, my last question for you isn't as closely related to your book, but as you know, as we were talking, you know, you've already noted a few times that you're a Methodist and have, you know, led a Methodist congregation, and we've talked also about the, you know, the pre-Civil War divide that happened among a number of churches. And I think it's fair to say that there is no denomination in the U.S. right now that is dividing and fracturing as much as the United Methodist. Your empathetic laughter there, you know, it's kind of a self-acknowledgement as someone, you know, there on the inside. So, you know, obviously the polarization is ripping the denomination in half. I wonder if you can give us some insights on your thoughts on what's happening and, you know, what, if anything, can be done?
Yeah. And it is a very serious thing for United Methodists, a somewhat ironic name that the denomination has at this juncture, because as you suggest, you know, it not immediately when it became the United Methodist Church, but in the 1930s, the Northern and Southern churches came back together. It became the United Methodist Church by drawing in a more German ethnic evangelical group, and the idea of unity there was a real motivation for the people who created the church, and also an important part of our United Methodist heritage is bringing that denomination together also spelled the end of what we called the central jurisdiction, which was literally segregating all of the African-American congregations into their own administrative structure. So the unity there was an important theme at the beginning. But again, as we add different identities, whether they are other ethnic groups, especially gender and sexuality identities and so forth, it becomes a challenge for churches to hold themselves together around that. And it's a challenge that we have largely failed in the United Methodist Church. One indication of the failure is not unlike an unhappy marriage, which is that at some point you stop talking about love and you go out and bring in the lawyers. And that's largely what's happening. We have a procedure now that congregations can opt out. What's interesting and disturbing to me is the number of congregations that are opting out, not because they are divided on these sexuality issues, but because they can no longer find anything in the structure of the denomination that really contributes to their sense of what it means to be the church. I think this is another one of those, this is probably one of those cases where we've been listening to the world too much and need to listen to the word again, which would have us taking up some space in the sense that I don't want to see a church that simply identifies itself with openness on issues of sexuality. I want to see a global church. And I have to recognize that there are places in the world where what works in downtown Chicago and North Dallas, where I go to church, is not going to work in the same way. Somehow if we're going to be a United Methodist Church, we have to hold ourselves together around that. That would really take up some space, wouldn't it, right? Because we would end up telling people on both sides of that identity politics divide, that's not what the church is about.
Well, I mean, I hate to end on a depressing note, but on the same time, it really highlights the importance of what you have been talking about and what you have written about in your book. What do we do when nobody is listening, leading the church in a polarized society? And Robin, I want to thank you for writing this book and joining us, because we do truly live in a polarized society. We have polarized churches, and we've got to find a way of taking up this space better to be a better witness, a better example to the one that we claim to worship and to follow. So I really appreciate your time and all that you have to offer us.
Well, thank you very much for the conversation and for your careful reading of the book. I enjoyed this opportunity to talk with you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program,
You can send those to me at bkaler@wardenway.org. Thanks for listening.